Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to tonight's Tribute to Revisionists, a special show in honor of tomorrow being January 27th, the second International Day of Commemoration in honor of the revisionists who introduced sanity to the Auschwitz death camp narrative. And this can be found at the website at www.january27th.org or http, you know, jan27.org. Well, is the title of that I just read to you a mouthful? That's because it's on the same day as that other one called the International Day of Commemoration in Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust. You know, that one that goes on in Poland at the fake camp they call an extermination camp. Our commemoration takes the place of that one, so we thought we'd give it a similar long title. That's the reason for it. Last year, for our first year, the first International Day of Commemoration in honor of the revisionists who introduced sanity to the Auschwitz death camp narrative, I also did a solo program, as I'm doing tonight, but on the Monday before that, the Heretics Hour had as guests Germar Rudolph and Bradley Smith to discuss the whole affair, and Frederick Tobin called in too. Tonight, I'm not repeating that this year, mainly because I just couldn't find the time to get around to organizing anything of that nature, and also because I had decided on what I'd like to do. And I didn't want to have any of my time taken up. You know how I am. And so I'm just doing it this way. But, of course, I have in mind always all these great revisionists of ours. But I am, as on the website, focusing on those who have passed away, because there's just too many great revisionists to be able to talk about them all, even on that website. So we kind of went to the extent of listing those who were deceased and adding to the list once others become deceased. It makes it sound a little macabre maybe, but really that's just the way it is, because there would be too many to list otherwise. Tonight I'm going to be focusing on some of these deceased revisionists that are not that well known out in the general public, let's say. And I really do want to get this message out to the general public. Most of my work I do, I'm really thinking of those who are already clued in. Because of the type of things I like to talk about, they're mostly not the people who are uninitiated, are not ready for them. But in this case, I had been thinking that this particular website and this particular kind of message about the revisionists should really be more properly directed to those who are not already on board and who are not already clued in and who need to have their minds brought into in a way that they can accept, you know, in a way that is kind of leading them on the right, in a way that's not too radical or too mean-sounding. I get a little mean-sounding at times. So I'm hoping that this program tonight will be able to be passed around, will be able to be to show up on other sites and other places, and we'll get a wide hearing. I'm hoping that I can get a wider audience at Blog Talk. I've been thinking lately about how I should pay more attention, be more appreciative of having an audience on Blog Talk that is different from the audience that I have naturally at CarolynJaeger.net. So this particular program, I'm quite aware of that. I'm devoting this program to, as I said, to the revisionists themselves, because that is where we want to direct our attention on this day, and away from the frauds and fakes who are being featured all day tomorrow as the last of the survivors. And oh, what a group they are. They have been dribbling out the stories about these survivors for the last few days especially. So I have been looking at some of them, and I'm going to cover just a little bit of space to these survivor stories, to the more outrageous aspects of them, because I think it's an important to compare the two kinds of people. What they're going to be listening to tomorrow are outrageous stories that no intelligent person who's actually thought about it could possibly accept as true. And yet they're all going to sit there, and all these distinguished people and world leaders and so on, or the people that the world leaders have sent in their place, they're going to act like this is all just amazing and so emotional and so important to be remembered and to be preserved down through the ages and to never forget and all that. So I'm going to make that contrast tonight, because when I use the word island of sanity in the title of this program, because that is how it is for me. When I read these things from the Holocaust industry, I get so agitated, I get so angry, I get so depressed, or just so, mostly I get angry, but and disturbed. But when I read revisionists, especially some of my favorite ones, I just feel like I'm in this wonderful place of peace and sanity and intelligence and wisdom and just goodness and good people. And basically, though, sanity, you know, people who can think sanely. And this is what we're going to see tonight, I hope, what I'm going to try to bring out. I've just explained why we have the title and why I'm going to talk about some of these atrocity stories. And one thing I came up with from these survivor stories is that the gas chamber and Dr. Mengele are still the most popular themes. And they're really, it should be used as a giveaway, because one thing that can be said without any contradiction, without fear of contradiction, although people will, but they won't have anything good to back it up, is that, number one, the revisionists from the beginning have looked at the gas chamber story as being one of the more improbable aspects of what maybe had not yet started to be called the Holocaust, but the concentration camp situation and what took place there, as was depicted in the Nuremberg tribunals. And they started to question the gas chamber idea. And it has by now been proven conclusively, except for a few hard-headed rebels or something, that the gas chamber story is improbable and impossible, and that there were no gas chambers anywhere, and they've never been able to show it or prove it, and it's been possible to prove otherwise. So there were no gas chambers, and this is what we should be holding on to with our life, and not give way in this at all. There are no gas chambers except for cleaning mattresses and clothing and so on from lice, but not people. They would use showers and disinfectant baths and things like that for the people. But there was no gas used to exterminate people. And the other one, Dr. Mengele, it's been shown that Dr. Mengele was just a decent kind of a doctor there doing his job. He was kind and considerate, and most of the people rather liked him. But as things go in camps, they start telling stories. You know how women can, when the women were separated from the men, and when they're sitting around talking together, as they would have been, they had plenty of time to do it, in their barracks and so on, and they'd start talking about Dr. Mengele. Pretty soon one will say, well, I heard this about him, and another one, well, I heard. Pretty soon they're all imagining and telling stories about Dr. Mengele, and they get bigger and bigger, and then they put themselves in it too, so to make it more, to make themselves feel more important maybe, or make it all more interesting. And this just takes on a life of its own, as did the people going to gas chambers. So when you hear these two subjects in a survivor story, I say that that's a giveaway that this person is lying, that this person is making it up or is simply repeating things that they have been hearing from others. It's possible that, I'm not saying they don't believe it, but that they don't believe it based on any kind of evidence or anything that they know. So they're either lying or they're just passing on third person information. They cannot be telling the truth about themselves. And that's a pretty good way to judge these things. So one of our, to try to get through this, I could take up probably the whole first hour reading these survivor stories, so I'm going to have to just take out the highlights here because I want to spend most of my time on reading some of the things that revisionists have written. And so one of the people that's going to be there tomorrow, as far as I can tell, is someone named Rizard Horowitz, who is 75, and I believe he's supposed to be a Hungarian Jew. A lot of these are Hungarian Jews. They're the ones who have survived the longest or somehow, and the most vocal of them all, too. And he says that he got there in September of 44. Now, they're all talking about Auschwitz, see? And he remembered at the end, before, at the time that Auschwitz was liberated, he was 5 years old, but he remembers several scenes from the end. And he says, I know we were at one point lined up to be killed just before the liberation when one of the SS people arrived screaming that the Russians were coming. So they just dropped everything and ran off and left us. Now, there's some common elements in this story, but the whole thing could not have happened because that's not the way the end came about in the first place. And the SS people, somebody wouldn't run into where these people were lined up and start screaming, the Russians are coming. They knew the Russians were coming, and they left long before the Russians got there. But anyway, this guy has this story, and they lined him up to be killed because they were leaving, and they didn't want to leave any living people behind. Well, that just didn't happen. So this is a total fiction. He may have seen something going on, but he's confused at all, but that doesn't make any excuses for him because he's just making something up here. And but fortunately, it doesn't fit the facts of what was taking place there and how these people would behave and act. So here he's an honored guest there tomorrow, and he's going to be saying this, and everybody's going to be listening and acting like it's all so moving and so important, which anybody who really knew. No, he's not going to be there. Sorry for saying that. He's been there many times before, but they said he's not going to attend this year. His sister is going to come in his to represent the family, and she's also survived the camp. So maybe she'll tell this story in his place. Now, the next one I want to mention is Josh Friedenberg, unless they say it Friedenberg. He is an assistant treasurer of Australia. He is actually leading the Australian delegation to the commemoration tomorrow in Poland. And he's got his own story, and he's going to tell it. He's going, I think so. They had it in the newspaper, and I think he says that he's going to go through all this remembrance tomorrow. And what he says, he's got a lot of these things that set off alarm bells in it. His uncle, Harris Friedenberg, at age 24, was deported to Auschwitz where he worked unloading trains. And a few months later, he saw his parents, which would be Josh's grandparents, come off the train with his brother, his little brother, Milik, and sisters, Bella, Hella, and Rikuzia. Josh's uncle is Harris, who was 24. And he says that he watched when his family got off the train, and his father was demanding to be placed in the same line with his wife and daughters. He was placed there, and they were marched to the end of the train line, shot, and thrown in a mass grave. Now, this is an unlikely story, because I don't know that such things ever happened, and this man would not be so stupid as to demand of these guards in the situation that he was in, demand that he be stay with his, go along with his wife and daughters, like some kind of a hero, you know. And so they would have just told him no, and if he acted up, well, I don't know, he might have been knocked on the head, but I don't even think he would have been shot right there in front of everybody else. But he makes up this story, and Josh, his nephew, naturally accepts it and is telling the story. And then he says this: his uncle told him that the ground moved for days, as some were not dead when they were buried in this mass grave that his relatives had been thrown into. And later, Peretz's brother Milik was taken to the gas chamber. So there we have a lot of unlikely things here, but the last one tells us that this is not a true story, and that it's all made up, because we've got the boy taken to the gas chamber. Josh's aunt then was a teenager when she arrived. She came from the Warsaw ghetto. She says that her parents and most of her siblings were sent directly to their deaths in Treblinka. Now, there's absolutely no information on this. How do they know they went to Treblinka? How do they know they died there? That's just another story that she gives, that all her family died somewhere. They died in Treblinka. And her surviving sister died from typhus at Auschwitz. But she survived through the whole thing. But here's another, the gas chamber comes up again, where she says that she worked as a seamstress, but one of the SS officers was sympathetic, or some of them were sympathetic to her sometimes, and one refused to let her be sent to the gas chambers when she badly injured her arm. Well, the lie alarm goes off again. She has to add that to the end of her story, which might have been halfway believable, but she almost was sent to the gas chambers too. Nobody can really point to the gas chambers. But now we come to a famous liar, Kitty Hart Moxon, and she's really been in the news because she's a big star of the day tomorrow, and a big star of the whole. Publicity of the event, because they've made a whole new film with her in it, walking around in Auschwitz with two young women trying to reach the young people in this way, because she's an old woman. And Steven Spielberg's company made this film, and they're showing it tomorrow on all over the BBC and the Discovery Channel is showing it all over the world and so on. It's called One Day in Auschwitz or something like that. I've forgotten already, but Kitty Hart Moxon, and some of the things she says don't make any sense at all. And she says that in Auschwitz, the obedient prisoner who stuck to the rules lived for 3 to 6 weeks. That is, she means that if you couldn't follow the rules, you'd end up dead, because they were designed, I guess, you know, to starve you and kill you. So you had to break the rules and kind of fend for yourself. And her thing is, she likes to portray every camp she was in as an absolute every man for himself kind of hellhole. And she comes up with everything bad she can think of to say about it. She says the camp food could not sustain life for long. This because the soup was and the soup was laced with a poison, a form of bromide. Now, that's another old story that we hear all the time, that the soup was poisoned, and I've heard bromide mentioned before. And yet, this is all approved by these people and approved by the governments of the world and so on, that these people are legitimate survivors telling the true story of what they experienced. Then she says that she was lucky with jobs. That's how she survived, because she got jobs indoors. And they have this thing now that they're saying that if you had to work out of doors, you wouldn't last very long. But if you could get a job indoors, well, those are the people who survived. Actually, the truth of it is that it used to be said, and more truthfully, that people wanted outdoor jobs because they got to get away from the camp and the barracks sometimes for days and weeks at a time. They had better food and more food. They had warmer clothing, and they had more of a sense of freedom and so on. So she also brings up Joseph Mengele, Kitty does. She met him too, and she says that she worked in the dysentery block once for a little while, and actually it was her mother, she says, who worked in the hospital. But now she's saying she was in this dysentery block. And one day all the patients had been killed on the orders of SS Dr. Joseph Mengele. No further details about that. I bet all this is in that film. If I get a chance to watch it, I will. She tells about, I'm going to skip that part. She says, we ate from rotting piles of food that littered the place, although this was forbidden. Well, now what? Rotting piles of food that were littering what place? She was working in the clothing warehouse, in goods warehouse for a while. Is that where the rotting piles of food were? She said she got good food there. So it must have been somewhere else that, in general, the camp people did this. And all over the place there was a rotting piles of food. But it was forbidden for them to eat it, but I guess they ate it because they didn't have anything else. That's what she's implying. And she also talks about the gas chambers, that she happened to be living in a barracks that was in close proximity to all four crematoria and which she calls gas chambers. And that meant that, and she says that she witnessed relentless killing from April to November 1944, one of the greatest number of victims were murdered. Well, she means that she saw people going in, it's not just her, but all of these women who were in this barracks, close there, they could see them. They saw groups of people going into these crematorium and not coming out again. And she says that it's been said that 1.5 million died. We, who were there, say it was in excess of 2.5 million. Our brains could not accept what we were witnessing, but it was happening. And then she has to add that among those who died in the gas chambers were 30 members of her own family. These people can't seem to control themselves when it comes to adding all these little details that are all these extras that other people are saying, and they have to say them too. There's a lot of impossible stuff here. I'm going to skip it because I'm taking too long. And you know, it's like she and her mother, who was 55 when they were liberated, and they were by then over around Bergen-Belsen, she says. They had been shipped all over the place in a way that was so entirely wasteful, in which 10,000, I suppose, women, but maybe women and men, who had to be moved to the West were put on trains and trucks and so on. They had a 2-week forced march, death march, which over the Sudeten Mountains, without food or shelter, they would have been dead after that. But no, they survived that and everything else. She and her over 50-year-old mother did all that. And this 10,000 that they originally sent through this torturous way to the West, only 200 survived the journey. So the Germans lost 10,000 workers. They're confused about whether the Germans wanted them to work or whether they just wanted them dead. So they went through all these strange ways to kill them. And here's one that when they got to Bergen-Belsen, they were put inside sealed cattle trucks, and they were expected to die in there. She meant train cars, and then she says the train was abandoned, and they are expected to die. But they took turns breathing through a crack in the floor, and a lot of the women in there died, but not her and not her mother. And, you know, her mother and her both went to Britain after the war and survived, and her mother lived for a long time yet. And then they were taken out of there by some Germans, and then they were liberated. But, you know, this she says, what people need to understand is that many of the perpetrators had chosen to become killers and had volunteered. Now, this is the message she wants to get across, and this is the message that those who back her want to get across, that these German perpetrators were not just following orders. No, we have to understand that they wanted to kill, and they had volunteered because some of them, she says, some SS members had declined certain duties, and they were not punished and were given alternative assignments. Well, she doesn't know. What do they know? But that's what they're saying, so that they want to make sure that the ones who they point to as the worst ones were really cold-blooded killers and not just doing their job. And she says the crucial question is, what turns ordinary men into killers? All right, then we're going to see there Alex Brummer, who is another British Jew. I think these all come from Britain, so except for the Australian. He's got this story, and it's got Joseph Mengele in it. And let's see if he mentions the gas chambers. I don't remember, and I have to rush through him. He's got the story that came down in his family for his cousin and his young aunts, who were about the same age as his cousin, who were in Auschwitz, and how they survived, and that his grandparents, his grandfather and grandmother, were marched from their dairy farm in Hungary, probably, and to the death camps and perished in the gas chambers. So, you know, that's not true. He doesn't know what happened to them, I guess, but they didn't perish in any gas chambers. We've already decided that. We've already figured that out. And then he says that when you go into the crematoria, which is the one in Auschwitz, one is the one he's talking about, where the iron sign reads Arbeit macht frei, he still smells the burning corpses, or anybody even can smell the burning corpses, even 5 decades later, because it still permeates that building. See, and what an imagination he has, and how crazy it is to say something like that, because the cremation ovens in the Auschwitz one rebuilt fake gas chambers were brand new, installed by the Soviets in 1946, because the others, the old ones, had original ones had been removed. So these cremation ovens had never been used, and yet he says that he can smell the burning corpses that still permeate the place, and nobody else smells it. I certainly didn't smell anything. And then he says that Joseph Mengele's henchmen had experimented on his aunts, who were barely out of puberty. Now, he's not saying Joseph Mengele himself, but Joseph Mengele's henchmen, and he calls them the Nazi doctors. And then he comes up with a piece de resistance, in my opinion, because he's one of the ones going to be bringing the message that the survivors of the survivors are also very much damaged psychologically by what their elders went through and the stories they've heard. And he writes, and I think he's going to give this speech tomorrow. He writes, the physiological scars may have healed, but the psychological impact has cascaded down the generations. In other words, we're all in need of financial compensation because we have to see get our mental health care and so on, because this psychological impact of this is affecting us too. And he says that his family lives with the past every day, and his Aunt Rosie lost her sense of smell because of the stench of the camps. The filth she was forced to live with has left her with an obsession with cleanliness. Well, there was no stench in the camps. The camps were clean. You don't know, they were always cleaning the barracks because the people weren't so clean. But they make it look all dirty now. But they were clean, and they didn't smell. And that's what truthful witnesses will tell you. And then he goes on adding to the thing that why they need, why the harm goes down through the centuries. He says, if anybody who even set foot in one of these places, meaning a concentration camp, even for a few hours, it is easy to understand that that the misery was truly a life sentence. He said, it's such a terrible place that even if you just were there for a short time, you had a life sentence upon you of what this did to you. Well, and so on and so on. He goes, there's so much more. I need to move on. Two more people I'm going to mention real quickly. Sam Pivnik. Have you read about Sam Pivnik? Apparently he goes way back, and he's been doing this, you know, telling his story for years now. He's also in Britain, and he's recalling now the moment he encountered Dr. Joseph Mengele, the Nazi monster who conducted sinister medical experiments. And he says that Mengele was wearing his white coat and making his rounds. Now, what rounds? You know, this wasn't the selection at the train ramp. This was more like he's in a hospital or just in his barracks. And he says that Mengele was making his rounds. I was shaking with terror. He was 14 years old at the time, he says. And we all knew, you know, that's another thing. When they say we all knew, they don't have to prove anything. They don't have to show if this was true or not, because they all knew it. You know, that's how it goes. We all knew anyone not able to stand by their beds was for the gas. He came to me and his finger pointed to the left, the gas chamber. So he got this from the stories at the selection at the train ramp with the incoming people just coming in. But he's using it now. He's got to say that Mengele is using his finger instead of that stick he had. He's going to point to the left for the gas chamber. And his finger went to the left. You know, he never says anything. He's too, he's just a frightening figure. And Pivnik says, I burst into tears and threw myself at his feet. I think I even kissed his boots. Mengele hated to be touched by Jews, and I could have faced a bullet for that. To this day, I don't know why, but he moved away. Later, I was told I could stay. Well, there you go. He wanted to have a dramatic story. Mengele first said gas chamber, then he just walked away and changed his mind. He doesn't know why. Naturally, he doesn't know why. But that's his big story of meeting this man. So this one has both the gas chamber in it, the belief in the gas chamber, and Mengele. This is one big lie, ladies and gentlemen. But they have him in the Daily Mail, and he's an old man now, and he's got the biggest ears I've ever seen. He looks, there's something very alien, freakish looking about him. He's got this little kind of a, maybe it's a little shriveled face a bit, and he's got these huge ears that I swear two of those ears would cover the whole of his face, I think, because they're so long. So finally we have Susan Pollock, who says that when she was liberated, she was hospitalized immediately for tuberculosis, typhoid, and severe malnutrition. But on liberation, I was virtually a corpse, unable to walk, and would soon have died. Now, this again is at Auschwitz, so obviously maybe she was in the hospital there when the Russians showed up. Now, you don't know. She doesn't say, you see. They just want to focus on how sick and how badly they've been treated. And she says that she tells a lot of lies about traveling in dark closed wagons with no food or water. We've heard this so many times, but it was not like that. They did have water, and they did have some food. They're supposed to have brought food of their own, and they all did. And then she says when they arrived at Auschwitz, her mother was gassed. Well, there's the alarm bell goes off again. You know she's lying. Her brother was working in a squad removing bodies to the ovens. So he was one of those commandos who were burning up the Jews, his fellow Jews. And supposedly these people, workers, were killed every few months and new ones brought in. But that didn't happen to him because he survived. She says here he did. And let's see, I would say that if she was as sick as she was, why didn't they send her to the gas chamber, you know, at the end, towards the end? Or there's the other ways they could do away with her, but they let her live as sick and helpless as she was, according to her. Now, she also makes a point that is one of the things that I think they're taught to emphasize, and she says that she's been bearing testimony for many years. She says, I haven't gotten over it, nor do I want to, but we are compelled to share these memories to show what discrimination, no matter how small, might lead to. And that's the other another message that they're intent on giving out these days, that we have to wipe out all intolerance and discrimination in the world, every little bit of it, because it leads to what happened to the Jews, and it leads to genocide. And, you know, they play this up, and people will sit there and take it in and kind of halfway agree with that without thinking. Oh, I want to mention now the picture that I used. I've got it both at Blog Talk and at my Carolyn Yeager website. And the cartoon, so to speak, it's not really, well, it is, that I used for this program. And it shows a bunch of people standing there with a guide or a knowledgeable person, supposedly, showing them the collapsed roof of the so-called gas chamber in Birkenau, and saying to them, well, you see these holes here. You see the four aligned 10-inch square openings, and this is where they poured down the Zyklon B pellets to kill the 2,000 people locked inside, you know, down in the gas chamber. They packed them in that to the extent of 2,000. And these people standing around are looking at it, but they're not really seeing anything, and they're just saying, oh, horrible, oh, they're just all reacting to that, boo-hoo-hoo, this is just terrible. And this little boy is standing over there, and he says, he's just looking, he says, there's no opening, there's no opening. And we know that there weren't, they didn't have these openings in where they said the gas chamber was in Birkenau, and at Auschwitz they added some. In 1946, the Russians added them on the roof. They changed the roof. They did all kinds of things there. But here, this one, this typifies everything that we're talking about tonight, that you have the man. Who is the revisionist here? The revisionists are the little boy. Little boy who's just actually looking and thinking and using his own brain, and the others. The tour guide represents like the survivors telling their story, or the Holocaust historians who are repeating these stories and using the survivor stories as evidence for what took place. And he's acting like the authority, see. And the rest of them are the general public and believers who listen to what this so-called expert is saying and don't question it. Don't have a critical mind about it, and are just going along with what he's saying, even though they can't see any holes. They can't see them, but they're imagining that they must be there if he says so. But the little boy is looking and saying, no, I don't see any here. So that's basically what the whole thing is about. The whole revisionism is that you have people, and not just the people we call revisionists, but people who think about it and pay attention. You have them looking at this story and saying, wait a minute, there's a whole lot of things wrong with this story. But then you have the rest of the public just going along because the expert is saying things, and they're accepting it without using their own thinking about it. And that's really sums up, that's why I use it there, it really sums up the whole story of the whole thing. So now I'm able to move on to the revisionists. And you will see on the website of January27.org committee, you will see the names of the earliest revisionists, all of whom are now deceased. They are Maurice Bardèche of France, Paul Rassinier of France, Louis Marchalcot of Hungary, Louis Fitzgibbon of Britain, Thies Christofferson of Germany, David McAlden of the United States, Wilhelm Steglitz of Germany, Walter Sanning of the United States, Carl Nordling of Finland and Sweden, Roger Garaudy of France, Robert Countess of the United States, Arthur Vogt, V-O-G-T. I'm going to talk about him a little, but I cannot be sure that I'm pronouncing his name right, but I don't know what else it would be. Arthur Vogt of Switzerland. And you can read more about all these men on the website www.revisionist.com, and a lot of others too, but they're all on there. And two attorneys who defended revisionists are mentioned. They are Jürgen Rieger of Germany and Douglas Christie of Canada. But two more names need to be added to this group at this time, but rearranging the table to fit them in has proved too challenging for us, and so they're not there yet. But I want to introduce them to you tonight, and I'd like to find a way to add them. They are François Duprat. Duprat. Huh. François Duprat, and he, in French, of course, and he was born in 1940, and he wrote an article, The Mystery of the Gas Chambers, in 1967, and he also distributed the French edition of Did 6 Million Really Die? He was in the process of distributing that, or I mean at the time that he was distributing that book in France, he was assassinated in an automobile bomb blast in which his wife lost both her legs. And the people, the group that claimed responsibility for that, placing that bomb, was a Jewish Remembrance Commando. And they're very proud of it. And they were not, the police did not even look for them or did not try to find them or prosecute them. No one was ever prosecuted for this crime, because this what this Duprat was doing was so unacceptable and so unpopular at the time. So he was a real hero who lost his life at age 40 over the work that he was, over revisionist work, and his wife lost, they had some children, his wife lost her legs. Horrible, really, when you think about it. And he was a member of the Front National, and at that time, the Front National was not at all critical of this kind of activism, but they were not promoting it either, because it was too dangerous and for a political party. But let's see. And the bomb attack was so sophisticated that it was difficult for a lot of people to believe that the government, that no government agency was involved. And so if you think about what government that might have been, if there was government involvement, you can think about which one it would be. It would have to be Israel, I would say. Now, the other one I would want to mention tonight is Darius Ratajczak. He's Polish. And he was born in 1962, and he died in 2010. Yeah, he also died because of his revisionist work. He wrote a book. He was an instructor at the Opel University in Poland, and it's a pretty big university, and he was popular with his students and so on. And he was a history teacher, and he had a PhD in history. He wrote a book called Dangerous Themes. I don't know if that's his only book, but this book was eventually seized, and he was dismissed from his teaching post. He was banned from all Polish universities for 3 years, and after that he couldn't get back into any university. He was forced into menial odd jobs. And in 2010, he was discovered dead in his car. And so I'll give more details now about how this all came about. In this book that he wrote in 1999, it came out in 1999. While he was at the university there. And he had only a 5-page section in it that was headed Holocaust Revisionism. 5 pages in this book. Well, it's kind of a short book, it says. But what he was doing was, I guess, talking about dangerous themes historically. And in it, he matter-of-factly cited the work of nonconformist researchers and historians such as Paul Racinier, Robert Faurisson, David Irving, and Ernst Zundel, who had contended that there was no German plan or program to exterminate Europe's Jews, And he cited forensic investigations carried out at the Auschwitz and Birkenau camps by Fred Leuchter and Guillermo Rudolph in their conclusions that Zyklon B could not have been safely used to kill large numbers of Jews, as alleged, and that for technical reasons, the familiar claims of wartime killings of millions of Jews in gas chambers are not possible. Well, we need to point out that when he was brought to court over this, he pointed out that he did not endorse these views. He only gave these as the views of these critics and revisionists, so to speak, about the gas chambers in the camps. But he published 320 copies of this book at his own expense in 1999, and only a few were sold, and some of them were given away before the police came along and seized them. So when he went to court, and he was brought to court by, guess who? Critics. The government wasn't going to bring him to court, but critics, and read Jews for that, charged that his book represented the first serious case of Holocaust denial in Poland. And these critics noted that he had published articles in patriotic nationalist periodicals. Wow, can't have that, can you? And so he was charged with having violated a Polish law that makes it illegal to publicly deny crimes committed in Poland by the German National Socialist regime or by the Communist regime. And he acknowledged that he had presented these arguments, but as I said he was only presenting views to his students from, you know, from different arguments back and forth, because in his job as a teacher. Now, the court found that since the book's distribution was so limited, it was not so damaging. It was not damaging enough. And anyway, they let him off and they dropped the charges. Well, these critics didn't like that. So these critics thought that was too lenient, and they insisted that Radiszczak's crime, that he be deserved imprisonment. They wanted him to be imprisoned, and they demanded a 10-month prison term. So even though his students at his university signed petitions supporting him, and he felt he had a strong case, and he was pretty confident that he would get he appealed for an outright acquittal. He was pretty confident. He was an idealist, this man. I've read some things that he wrote that he thought that history was about scholarship, and that it wasn't about, naturally, about courts and politics and so on, and that people should, that it had to be, you had to have freedom to study history and come to whatever conclusions you came to and so on. And he really loved history, and he seemed to have these high ideals about it, and I believe he thought they would hold up. And so he was pretty devastated when they didn't, because eventually he was found guilty of a thing, and he had to refrain from doing anything similar for 1 year, and then they dismissed the case in 2002. But what the what these critics brought about was that he was prevented from working as a teacher for 3 years, and after that, and after all the publicity and so on, he couldn't get a job in any university, and all he could do was he was forced to work at menial employment and odd jobs. Sounds like what's going on with Eric Hunt, who's been ruined as far as being employed anywhere. And so, after some years of this, and I think I don't know if he and his wife were divorced or what happened, because he had two children, but they don't mention his wife at the end at all. He was survived by his son and daughter. Anyway, his body was found in a car. They don't know if it's his car, but it may have been a car that he had bought, parked near a shopping center in Opole in Poland. And he had been there, he had been dead in there for nearly 2 weeks when they looked in there. And nobody missed him, you know, nobody cared about him. And the cause of death was uncertain because he was there so long, he was dead for so long. He was 47 years old. Duprat was 40, and he was 47. And that's very, very sad story. That's just, I don't know which is better, to go in a big bomb blast or worn down like they did to him. Those are two, they're not the best known, or they didn't do them a big work or anything, but they certainly were persecuted, and they died for their beliefs and trying to be able to write and speak the truth. And if with this poll is more like with about free speech. But that's how absolutely adamant they were in those days that nothing come out. See, they couldn't take it that even the revisionist arguments against the gas chambers could be published in a book, even if they weren't endorsed, or even if later, in his later edition, he said he didn't endorse them, but he wanted this people to know what they were. You see, he was trying to keep his book going, he kept publishing it in new editions. So, you know, he thought he could somehow get around the whole thing, but he couldn't, because they don't want anybody to hear the arguments, because they make too much sense. So, I have to move on now to the earliest revisionist of all, generally considered the father of revisionism, and that is Paul Racinier, a Frenchman whose first book was Crossing the Line in 1949. And in this book, he described his experience in the Buchenwald camp in an objective, unemotional manner. And so he included a critical depiction of the prisoner government in this book, and he was a socialist, and he was arrested by the Gestapo in France and taken to Buchenwald because he was working against the Germans, and he was kind of in the French underground, and he was an opponent of the National Socialism. And so that's why he was there, and he kind of, it seems to me that he accepted that's what you do if you're going to be opposed to the powers that be. So he also spent some time in Dora, another nearby camp. But that's where he was mostly. And in this book, he talks mostly about the prisoner government that was there, and that was that most of the brutality, in fact, all of the brutality, was caused by and the high death rate was caused by this brutality of these communist prisoners from Western Europe who ran the camp at the lower level, you know, at the barracks prisoner level. They were in charge. They put themselves in charge, and they were allowed to do it because the Germans didn't ever go into barracks, and they didn't want to, the SS didn't want to be hanging around there and didn't want to run all that business. They stayed pretty much as far outside as they could, and they let these camp inmates run their business themselves. And so the big bad meanies were very, very authoritative and they took most of the food. The ones they didn't like, they let them starve and things like that. It was very brutal, but I think the SS had other things to be concerned about, and they didn't have enough personnel to be doing all that work, so doing all that overseeing. So that's what happened there. And then he wrote, Racinier, that book was well received in France, and it sold well. And so then he wrote another book, which came out in 1950, The Lie of Ulysses, in which he analyzed the literature by some of the concentration camp survivors. This is when he gets to this. And he countered the claim by Eugen Kogan, K-O-G-O-N, that the prisoner government at Buchenwald worked against the SS. That's what they wanted to put out, you see, that this prisoner government, they were like some kind of heroes, and they were trying to help the prisoners and work against the SS, who were the bad guys. But he says that's not the way it was. He was there, but see, he's an honest man and a scholar. And he asserted that the mainly communist functionaries were only interested in their own self-preservation. They weren't doing anything noble for anybody. They didn't have any any plan like that. They were just looking out for themselves, and they avoided post-war prosecution by threatening their any witnesses. They would give strong threats against anyone who would speak out against them. And they were very, very tough. So this book, though, now the second book was attacked in the French Assembly, and both the author and the man who wrote the foreword, Albert Perraz, wrote the foreword, were sued for libel by, I think I know which it is, but anyway, it says here just an organization with an interest in preserving the post-war propaganda. Afterward, however, after a lengthy judicial process, Rossignol and Perraz were both acquitted, but he was expelled from his leftist socialist organization, that party that he had been a member of for so long. They didn't want him either because of what he wrote in that book. But an expanded edition was published in 1955, and it, along with the first one, enjoyed good sales. So eventually they got over that, and he was able to sell his book there, but he continued to write. And in 1961, he wrote Ulysses Betrayed by His Own, the English translation, in which Rassignol elaborated on the themes he discussed in The Lie of Ulysses, and he further published The True Eichmann Trial, or The Incorrigible Victors, in 1962, which contained an attack on the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, as well as the post-war Nuremberg trial. So you see, before anybody else pretty much was doing anything, it was only 15 years after, 50, 60. Yeah, you know, it had not really taken hold yet, but he got real interested in all these themes. And he definitely was not a National Socialist. He was still a socialist, a regular, you know, left-wing socialist. Anyway, he criticized the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, and he also criticized the Auschwitz trials that were held in Frankfurt in the 60s, and the federal German government banned him from attending those trials. It's called the American puppet regime in Bonn at that time, called West Germany, and he started being branded with labels of anti-Semite and neo-Nazi at that time, because he was investigating these events, and these people didn't want him to do that. He was being impartial, and they didn't like that. Then he wrote The Drama of the European Jews, which was published in 1964. And this was in response to Raoul Hilberg's very famous book, The Destruction of the European Jews, so which appeared in 1961. So he answered Raoul Hilberg with his Drama of the European Jews. You can imagine what he was saying in there, that it was all over-dramatized. And he criticized the witness reports that it was based on, which were, for the most part, Rudolf Höss, the SS commander of the Auschwitz camp, who was hanged by the Poles in 1947, Miklos Nyaisli, that Hungarian Jew who claimed to have been a medical doctor at Auschwitz in 1944. So, you know, he's a pretty well-known fabricator of what took place there. And the SS officer Kurt Gerstein, who died in French captivity in 1945. These are three lying witnesses who were provided much of the foundation of the gas chamber stories and the whole extermination camp stories at that time. And after, in this book, The Drama of the European Jews, Rassignol concluded that the Third Reich never had a deliberate policy of extermination of the Jews, whether by means of gas chambers or otherwise. He also did an exhaustive study of Jewish population statistics, and he said that he said that of the missing 6 million European Jews, because at that time they were just able to just say, well, there's 6 million less Jews in Europe now than there were, so there's 6 million were murdered. He said that 4.4 million had managed to emigrate before the war broke out. So he came up with the figure of 1.6 million Jews that could not be accounted for, rather than 6 million. So he went a long way. He all on his own, he just kept going and going. And his last book that he completed was titled Those Responsible for the Second World War. And it was published in the year of his death in 1967. He was one of the first historians to point out that the never-ending war crimes trials mainly served Zionist interests, since it enabled the State of Israel to demand and to receive vast amounts of compensation from the Germans. You know, he was one of the first to say that. And he was also, and he also said this was the main reason why very old Germans and others are still being hunted down by the Israeli Secret Service with their Western auxiliaries to be charged with having committed war crimes 70 years ago. See, this is really kind of unheard of, but Rasnier said they did it for the money. Now, it wasn't until 1978 that his books were published in English. So we were just catching on in the English-speaking world to this work that was going on. And that's about the time revisionism got going in the U.S., you might say, once more of this literature was made available. That's pretty amazing. It took until 1978. I'm going to go on now to, that was the Frenchman. Now I'm going to go on to the two Germans. Because I can't go into detail on all of the revisionists that are on the January 27th site, but and of course there's articles by living revisionists and lots of good material inside. But this one, Theis Christofferson, is truly one of my favorites, and he is a very, very sweet and kind-hearted and true-hearted, courageous man. He wrote, I'm going to read from an article that he wrote in 1985 for the Journal of Historical Review. But the book he wrote, and he mentions it here, is The Auschwitz Lie, or Die Auschwitz Lüge, which he put out because he and Wilhelm Steglitz both spent time at Auschwitz during the war. He spent the most time. He was there a year. In Auschwitz I, Christofferson wrote this book, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful book in the under section, What Was Auschwitz? That's an important section, and it's there to tell people what really happened at Auschwitz, what it really was, not what the make-believe story is. And Theis Christofferson's a lot of excerpts from his booklet, not all of it. And I've also started out with a section from part of the introduction from Wilhelm Steglitz, The Myth of Auschwitz, the Auschwitz Mythos. So these are two Germans that are very important in the beginning of the, in the early days of revisionism. And they were there. See, that's what's so interesting. They, not just reading what other people say about it, they were there and they tell about their own experience there. And so Theis Christofferson writes in this article, my booklet, The Auschwitz Lie, has become an under-the-counter bestseller. It has appeared in French, Spanish, Dutch, Danish, and even Hungarian, as well as in several English language editions. Remember, this was in 1985. Actually, there's nothing very remarkable about The Auschwitz Lie, except that it was written by someone who was in Auschwitz and who recorded his experiences and recollections. People generally prefer to read sensational reports, and my booklet is certainly not that. Now, I just want to bring out here that when I read this, it just makes me so happy to read what he has written, and it makes me so happy to read what Wilhelm Steglitz has written. It's such a strong difference from what the Holocausters, how they write and what they say. Which is just gets you so agitated and angry. But this makes me, I feel like, wow, I've come to something that's, Wow, I feel peaceful, and I feel good feelings, and I feel sanity. I feel intelligence and people, logic and reasonableness and so on. It's such a difference. And I have not read Paul Racinier, but if I did, I'm sure I would feel the same way, because I do. I read Maurice Bardèche, and I loved what he wrote. And this is the truthful view, and these are people who want to tell the truth. You can tell that they are. He goes on to write, in the spirit of Martin Luther, I tried to speak positively and influence things for the best. But I was accused of popular incitement for doing that. You know, the Volksverhetzung. I spent a year in prison, even though the charge of popular incitement was eventually dropped. However, the charges of contempt against the state and defamation of the Jews, who now enjoy special protection in this regard, were not dropped. I was also accused of defaming the memory of the dead. In this regard, the son of Count Schenk von Stauffenberg appeared as a co-plaintiff against me because I had called his father a traitor. All the same, there wasn't any need for a criminal indictment. He said, I wouldn't like it either if my own father had been insulted, and so I wasn't offended when Stauffenberg Jr. sought to rehabilitate his father's reputation. All the same, there wasn't any need for a criminal indictment. If he had sent me a letter justifying his father's actions, I certainly would have published the complete text of it in my magazine. He did run a magazine for a while, this Christofferson. Of course, I would also have commented on it, as I always do, with critical letters from readers. I'd like to describe my experiences and observations since the publication of my first report, my first person report about Auschwitz. When I wrote my report, I was criticized on the grounds that although I was in the camp and saw nothing of mass gassings, that fact did not necessarily mean that there were none. All the same, I can say with certainty that there were no mass gassings at Auschwitz. I don't write under a pen name. I even gave my address and telephone number. I have received thousands of letters and calls. Many of those who contacted me can confirm my statements, but are afraid to do so publicly. Some of those are SS men who were brutally mistreated and even tortured in Allied captivity. I also immediately contacted those who claimed to know more about mass gassings. My experiences were precisely the same as those of French professor Paul Racinier. I have not found any eyewitness to gassings, he means. Instead, people would tell me that they knew someone who knew someone else who talked about it. In most cases, the alleged eyewitnesses had died. Other supposed eyewitnesses would quickly begin to stammer and stutter when I asked a few precise questions. Even Simon Wiesenthal had to finally admit before a Frankfurt district court that he was actually never in Auschwitz. All of the reports I have heard about are contradictory. Everyone seemed to tell a different story about the gas chambers. They couldn't even agree about where they were supposed to have been located. This is also true of the so-called scholarly literature, which is full of contradictions. I want to try to explain how such stories get started. When I tell fairy tales to my grandchildren, I often speak as if I am there in the story myself, so that my children will believe them. I think that's a very excellent statement, because he says, you know, you're telling a fairy tale about these make-believe people, right? You know, this, they have names and they did this and that. But he says he often would put himself in the story so that it would be more believable to his children. So I can imagine the people telling the stories about the gas chambers and how people were beaten, shot, and killed, and so on, and all this stuff, worked to death, and no food. And when they're telling that because they heard it or other people have told it, well, pretty soon they start putting themselves in the story. Because then people will pay more attention and will more likely believe it. So now they're saying, this happened to me and I did this. And I think that's quite smart of him to see it that way. That's probably a lot happened quite a bit with a lot of these people who are telling all these stories. They did, none of this happened to them, but they heard up people talking about it. And so then they designed the story around themselves. He said many people also have a tendency to embellish what they say. Some enjoy getting others to believe their false tales. And then there are the so-called bull stories. Every veteran knows about these. Those interned in prison camps particularly like to invent and spread such stories. So I have an explanation for how the story got started, that corpses were burned in open fires at Auschwitz. There were also bull stories at Auschwitz. My maid, Olga, once told my mother, who was visiting me at Auschwitz, about a fire. Yeah, so, you know, he was living inside the Auschwitz camp, Auschwitz one, and his wife came and visited him for a while. His mother came and visited him. So it couldn't have been the kind of place that that they say it was. He said that Olga told his mother that about a fire in which people were being burned. So he says, I asked Olga about that. She didn't know anything for sure, but she said that a fire could always be seen in the direction of Bielitz. I drove in that direction, but found only a large industrial plant where inmates were also working. I looked over the entire camp and inspected all the fires and smoking chimneys, but I didn't find anything suspicious. I asked my colleagues, but they answered merely by shrugging their shoulders and saying that I shouldn't believe bull stories. There was indeed a crematory at Auschwitz. After all, 200,000 people lived there. He's talking about Auschwitz Birkenau when he says 200,000 people. And every city has a crematory. Of course, people died there as well, and not just inmates. The wife of SS Lieutenant Colonel Cesar, for example, died there of typhus. I was satisfied with those answers at the time. Today, I know much more about the matter. At first, those who died at Auschwitz were buried, but because of the high groundwater level, which was only 1 meter, in this area between the Vistula and Sola rivers, that practice couldn't be continued. A labor team headed by SS Staff Sergeant Mall, who had been in charge of the agricultural nursery at Risco, which was another camp very close by, which featured or specialized in agricultural work, growing things and nurseries and so on, plants, and was assigned to dig up the buried corpses and burn them. So this SS sergeant was given that assignment to dig up these corpses that they had buried and burn them because they were endangered because of the water table. And this was done on an open fire, he says. The most unbelievable stories were told about this procedure. And West German television even broadcast a film of this, which was supposedly made in secret by an SS man. So you can just imagine that a television station in West Germany did a film in which they said that the film of this going on, which was open and which was not secret, was made in secret by an SS man. So that's like they were looking at forbidden material that the Nazis were hiding, that the SS was had done these bad things, and they filmed it. Somehow this television station got hold of it. There's another factor which has played a role in all this. The defense attorneys for the so-called German war criminals were not entirely blameless. Every defense attorney wants freedom for his client, and as a result, the attorneys often argued that persons who were already dead were guilty of the alleged crimes. And this Sergeant Mall, who was mentioned above, was killed in action in the final days of the war. And what he means here, I'm sure, is that therefore, Sergeant Mall, who since he was already dead, could be blamed for crimes that they wanted to put on these SS people. And therefore, their SS client, the defense attorneys say they can try to get their SS client off by blaming whatever was supposed to have happened on an SS man who's already dead. So since he's dead, it doesn't matter. But you see, it does matter, and it set a bad precedent because they were then in a sense, admitting that these things were being done by SS men, when it should have, that shouldn't have happened. They should have denied all of it. But the it was the defense attorneys. And that's the truth, too. The attorneys told him to do these things in order to get to save their lives. So he goes on, during this period, I also received a report from the brother-in-law of Auschwitz Commandant Rudolf Huss. He lives in Flensburg, not far from my home. His report generally confirmed my own statements. Death sentences were certainly carried out, and hostages were also shot. I pointed this out in my booklet, but these executions were not carried out in the camp itself, otherwise it would have been heard. So people who say they saw people being killed and hung and shot and so on in the camp, he's denying that and saying that they didn't do any of that in the camp. And he says, I can't understand why Auschwitz is called a concentration camp. I consider it an internment camp. It's well known that enemy aliens are normally interned during wartime. In order to keep them from fighting against their host country, they are normally not expelled. If you send them out, if you kick them out of the country, they'll fight, they'll work against you from abroad. So the thing that you do is you intern them for the period of the war. It's common. Of course, one can argue about whether the Jews should have been considered members of an enemy nation. After all, the State of Israel wasn't founded until after the war. Nevertheless, the Jews had already declared war against us. And notice he says us. He really identified as a German all through that time with his government, with the National Socialist government. They had already declared war against us in 1933, as the London Daily Express had reported on 24th March of that year. On that basis, internment would have been justified even then. But the Jews weren't interned until the outbreak of war in September 1939, and even then, not all at once. I am thus one of the few who can report on the actual situation in the Auschwitz camp, and I have done so. What has it brought me? 2 years of living in exile and 1 year in prison, even though, prudently enough, there wasn't anything about it in my verdict. I would never have been imprisoned if I had not written the Auschwitz lie. The charge of contempt against the state was only a pretense. There's no parallel for such a charge in any other country of the Western world, not even in those that are still monarchies. So he says he was put in prison because he wrote that book. I lived in Belgium for two years. I'm going to skip this part because I'm going to have to move ahead here, unfortunately. He says a little further on, nowadays there's an awful lot of talk about democracy or the, quote, rule of the people, unquote. This doesn't exist for us today. We are still West German justice living under the rule of the occupation powers. In our homeland, there is only room for aliens and for those who serve foreigners. There was once a time when more than 90% of the population supported its leadership. I remember that time very well. There was no government peevishness, no unemployment, and no fear about the future. Anyone who lived during that time will never forget those things, despite the many lies which have been spread about that time and which are unfortunately believed. The right of national self-determination became a reality, he means in Third Reich Germany. It was never so disregarded as it has been since 1945. A national socialism could have been a model and guide for the entire world, but it was precisely those powers which ruled over and oppressed other nations which could not tolerate the right of national self-determination. And although many of the colonial empires have disappeared, the nations have been forced into a new and far more terrible form of dependency. U.S. capitalism and those behind it have won the struggle for world supremacy. Surveillance grows more and more pervasive. Orwell was thus not completely wrong. I have experienced it, and I believe we all experience it. Terror is now also being used. What can we do? Nothing. Nothing? I mean, like a question. Should we remain silent? Should we smother the cry of outrage in our hearts? Our writings may be banned. We may be thrown into prison. Our mail may be inspected. We may be attacked with fire and bombs. Our homes may be searched. We may be kept from obtaining employment or fired from our jobs. We may be slandered, ridiculed, and persecuted like the early Christians. But we will suffer and endure it all, and our enemies will thus achieve precisely the opposite of what they intend. Their actions make others interested in what we do. I believe in truth and in justice, and I know that one day they will prevail. Well, Christofferson wrote this in 1985. Now, 30 years later, what would he say today? Would he still say that we will prevail? I imagine he would. I imagine he would. Now, there's a lot to this Wilhelm Staiglitz, who was a German judge and historian and was an important revisionist writer, most notably for his detailed study Der Auschwitz Mythos, the Auschwitz myth. He got his degrees from the University of Rostock and the University of Göttingen, from where he received a doctorate in law in 1951, the very, very prestigious University of Göttingen. For years, he served as a finance court judge in Hamburg. He was the author of numerous articles on legal and historical subjects. During the Second World War, he served from mid-July to mid-September 1944 as an orderly officer on the staff of an anti-aircraft detachment stationed near the Auschwitz camp. He was only there for 2 months, July to September, and in Auschwitz I. But he had free access and unlimited access into the main camp, where the command that he was in contact with was headquartered. And, you know, this is the time of the so-called Hungarian murders in Birkenau, that in these months, and very much in these months, it's starting a little bit earlier, all this transfer of Hungarians to Auschwitz, Birkenau, and them being murdered in these gas chambers. And Christofferson was also there at this time. And he had access into Birkenau because he got some of his workers. You can read all about that in his booklet that's on the in the section What Was Auschwitz. Very, very interesting. It certainly wasn't any kind of slave labor. They were working with growing plants and nursery type of work, a nursery in the sense of baby plants, and growing new and unusual things and so on. And he got some of his help from Birkenau, and he went into Birkenau. And he didn't see anything like this. There's no way you could have avoided seeing it, what they say was going on there. Compare this to Kitty Hart Moxon. You know, she says she was there. And she said that she witnessed all these people going into the gas chambers and not coming out, and all this smoke and, you know, from the crematories and all this stuff going on from April to November 1944. That's what she says. But these two men who were there contradict that, and they're much more likely to tell the truth than she is. So, anyway, he died at the age of 89 in 2006. He lived that long. He's so recent and highly, highly, highly regarded. Well, there's this, what I have here is a paper he presented to the 1983 International Revisionist Conference. 1983. The other one from Christofferson was 1985. And he's writing about he's telling us about his book and its fate in the German Federal Republic. And he says, after the Second World War, I repeatedly expressed doubts in conversation with a wide range of people about the alleged atrocities in German concentration camps. It simply appeared to me my obvious duty to report in such conversations what I had seen, and for that matter, had not seen, in the Auschwitz region around the middle of the year 1944. At that time, in the so-called Stammlager, Auschwitz I, I saw orderly quarters and sanitary facilities and internees who were well-nourished and who appear to have either special and who appear to have neither special demoralization nor fear, let alone a fear of death. Moreover, I never noticed mistreatments of internees, nor in particular any signs such as clouds of smoke or the stench of burning corpses of mass extermination of human beings. And even though he wasn't in Birkenau, supposedly what all these Holocausters are always saying is that you could smell this stuff from miles away, and people did smell it from miles away. And so he would have certainly, even if he was in Auschwitz I, he would have smelled it and he would have seen signs, which he didn't. And he says in 1965, then, when the famous first Frankfurt Auschwitz trial was just being concluded, I was denounced as a Nazi by one of my judicial colleagues in Hamburg to the Jewish mayor of the city as a result of my remarks concerning Auschwitz. That led to the initiation of a disciplinary proceeding against me. Its objective was to expel me from civil service. The notable feature of this proceeding, which lasted, because he had been talking about this so far, he'd just been talking about it to people and was saying what he saw. But it got these people, these, you know, the same people, got word of it, got notice of it. And so they were trying to bring him down. He said the proceedings lasted nearly 2 years, and the goal was to make him ineffective during its course with the aid of a psychiatrist, apparently of Jewish origin. After it became obvious that the proceedings would probably not lead to the desired success as a result of legal factors. So then they try to say he needed a psychiatrist. I could only thank the energetic intercession of my defense attorney for the fact that nothing came of this scheme, which is otherwise known as characteristic only of the communist sphere of influence. I was acquitted for lack of evidence because the exact contents of my remarks could not be determined in the opinion of the disciplinary judge, who appeared to have a good opinion of me. This disciplinary proceeding was for me the first incentive to analyze the Auschwitz problem in a somewhat more thorough manner. So it kind of backfired on them. It got him going. And he wanted to look into it further because he thought, wow, there's something here. And so I began to study the official literature about it. The more I read, the more improbable indeed seemed to me the thesis of the extermination camp of Auschwitz. More and more, I recognized that the descriptions of it were different from the atrocity propaganda of the First World War only insofar as the details were concerned. So he was realizing that it was atrocity propaganda. And around the middle of 1973, I acquired by chance the eyewitness report of T.S. Christofferson, published as a booklet under the title The Auschwitz Lüge. Christofferson, whom I did not then know, completely confirmed with his report the impressions which I myself had gained of Auschwitz in the year 1944. All the doubts about my own doubts, which occasionally occurred to me, were thus as if expunged, especially after I became acquainted personally with the author. My reaction was such because Christofferson had, after all, been a member of the command personnel of the ancillary camp of Ryskow for a whole year and had himself even picked out his labor internees from the ill-famed Birkenau camp. Naturally, he had thus obtained a much deeper insight into the conditions of the Auschwitz region than I. So, isn't this nice here, you know, this shows how important it is to speak out and do your thing. The fact that T.S. Christofferson had already published his booklet, and then that affected and influenced, I always want to call him Walter, but Wilhelm Staglich to go ahead with what he wanted, what he was doing, because he found that Christofferson's experience of Auschwitz was the same as his. And that was very, very encouraging to him. So he said, I no longer saw any reason not to release for publication my own impressions of Auschwitz, which even during the disciplinary proceeding had been recorded in writing in the archive of the German monthly periodical Nation Europa. Their publication took place in the October 19, 73 issue under my full name. That is the publication of his, not his book yet, but his impressions of Auschwitz in this magazine. Under his full name and with the note that I was a judge fulfilling my duties in Hamburg. I was quite cognizant of the risks involved in this, but I hoped that the ban placed for years on the critical discussion of Auschwitz had now been broken, and that after Christofferson's courageous appearance, other eyewitnesses in addition to myself would come forth who remembered the Auschwitz concentration camp as not being an extermination camp. Alas, my hopes were illusory. Had we Germans really, to use Lincoln's words, become a nation of cowards during the past decades? It appeared that this was the case. In any event, the smear campaign by nearly all the mass media, which commenced against me only a few days after the appearance of my Auschwitz report, had to be taken as an indication that further infractions of the Auschwitz taboo would be daring acts indeed. Although Christofferson's report was effectively killed by silence at the time, the Auschwitz mythmakers obviously did not want to put up with the circumstance that no less than a judge holding office was opposing their lies. The result was a further disciplinary proceeding against me, again with the objective of removing me from my judicial position. During the course of this proceeding, it was suggested to me to leave the service voluntarily and that the proceeding could then be suspended. Since my health was no longer the best, simply as a result of the emotional disturbances and constant professional disadvantages connected with the first proceeding, even after my acquittal, I finally took the hint and requested early retirement. Under such circumstances, I in fact had little inclination to continue in my position as a judge. My request was granted at once. Presumably, the judicial officials were happy to get rid of me in this manner. Nevertheless, the disciplinary proceeding was continued against me, now with the declared objective of disallowing my claims to a pension. Although the people prosecuting me did not attain this objective, my pension was nevertheless reduced by 20% for a period of 5 years. And he goes on to say that, you know, this was a financial disadvantage was a problem, that he had plenty of time, but he didn't have the money that he felt he needed to carry on with his book. But he did go to work on his book, and this, he says, was the birth of his book, Der Auschwitz Mythos. And he said, I'll read this part. In this work, I focused on the question of the alleged mass gassings, because this is essentially the basis on which the myth of terror is founded. The restriction in scope to the core of the Auschwitz legend seemed appropriate to me in order to finally treat the basic problem as completely as possible, a treatment which had not yet been undertaken, even by the various revisionists. At the beginning of my research, he says, he talks about Dr. Alfred Schippel, a very good historian who's a moderate revisionist, he called him, and the work that he did. I'm going to have to skip ahead here. There's some parts that I really want to read. This is quite long, but what I'll do is I'll put I'll link to these articles on the program page. He says here, it is naturally impossible within the limitations of this paper even just to hint at all the questions and views treated in my book. Therefore, I must confine myself to making a few important points. Now, this book that he wrote is out in English, but there's a new edition being done now. And when this new edition is finished, and if it is possible to, after it's out for a while maybe, to publish it here on January27.org, because there are a couple full-length books there already, all translated into English and posted there for people to read, and this would be another one that I think would be good to have there. I will do that. But I don't know how available that would be as a free read. So going on with this, he said this was the birth of his book. Furthermore, one must note that the advocates of the extermination thesis have hitherto studiously avoided even just touching on the question of the technical requisites for the claimed gassings of Jews. Nevertheless, these people do base their case on documents, and he starts talking about the documents, and he talks about how documents can be forged and can be improperly interpreted. It's basically what's happened with these documents. They either interpret them in a misleading way, or they have they're partial or all total forgeries. He says, in the first place, the documents can be made to serve the purposes of the extermination thesis only with the aid of arbitrary interpretation of terms. This is true of all documents in which there is talk of resettlement of Jews, expulsion of Jews, deportation, evacuation, and similar things. So he was saying this in the 1980s already. The advocates of the extermination legend, accordingly, speak regularly of code designations or code words and euphemisms. And we're familiar with that. He also says a number, where does he bring that up? Brings up the Von Sieg protocol documents. He says, in the second place, a number of these documents give the impression of being forgeries. I wish to elucidate this point using the example of the so-called Von Sieg protocol to the critical analysis of which I devoted quite a bit of space in my book. Well, I'm not going to go into that, but he goes into a lot of detail on that even here. And he says he devotes a lot in his book to it. And he comes to the conclusion anyway that the Von Sieg documents are forgeries. And he explains how he does all that. And now he says, now I come to the alleged eyewitness accounts concerning the claims of mass gassings in Auschwitz. A person who has suffered generally has the inclination to exaggerate his suffering. Racinier called this the Odysseus complex, in recognition of the legendary fact that travelers returning from long journeys often tell tall tales. The person who has caused the suffering will generally attempt to palliate it or to shift the blame for it onto others, which is the so-called scapegoat theory. Statements and reports of experiences by participants in certain happenings can therefore never serve simply by themselves as an objective portrayal of history. And a little bit further on, he says, now, indeed, these statements and reports which have contributed to the founding of the Auschwitz myth will scarcely appear convincing to the objective historian who is working on a scholarly basis, as he and the other revisionists are. They're not going to be convinced by these statements by survivors, so-called survivors. And this is the case because they not only contain contradictions and inconsistencies amongst themselves, but contain, in some cases, even internal contradictions. I have already mentioned that there's not a single report which even somewhat credibly describes the technical procedure of the mass gassing and of the subsequent destruction without a trace of the bodies. Each of these reports contains such crass impossibilities and physical nature that it is shown by this alone to be a lie. And he even mentions Kitty Hart, who's now Kitty Hart Moxon, but she used to just be Kitty Hart. Somebody married her, I guess. In this connection, he says, I need only to call to mind such eyewitnesses, he puts in quotes, as Dr. Rudolf Verba, Miklos Naizli, Kitty Hart, or Philippe Mueller, whose accounts are, in part, simply absurd. We need not waste another word concerning such accounts. And he talks about Rudolf Huss quite a lot and how he believes that talks about his memoirs, the book he wrote, you know, that was published 10 years after he died, something like that. He says, strangely, however, these alleged memoirs were not published until 1958 in German and on the basis only of a photographic copy which the Poles had placed at the disposal of the present director of the Institute for Zeitgeschichte, Professor Dr. Martin Grosseth. He was the director of there. The question as to why publication did not take place until 11 years after the writing, even though the memoirs are supposed to be an extraordinarily important historical source, has up till now been neither posed nor answered by the advocates of the extermination legend. And so he says, I was the first scholar to subject the Huss memoirs to a detailed critical analysis as to their source. And he says, there can be no further doubt that in the case of parts which have to do with the mass extermination of the Jews, Huss was either writing the document under coercion, or those parts are a forgery which originated after his death. I'm inclined toward the second possibility because, to mention only one reason amongst a number, the publication did not take place until a decade after the alleged writing of the document. And this, it goes on, and I have to move on to my final revisionist that I want to talk about. There's a real good part in here, but I have to skip it. And the last one I want to mention is Arthur Vogt, V-O-G-T, who is Swiss, and he didn't write any big books, or he's not known for anything really in particular, but he was a staunch advocate of revisionism for many years, mostly after he retired. And I have something here from Jürgen Graf, who is remembering Arthur Vogt. Arthur Vogt was very important to Jürgen Graf becoming a revisionist. And Jürgen writes, before 1991, I did not know anything about revisionism. While I thought that the 6 million figure might be somewhat exaggerated, I never had the slightest doubts as to the reality of the Nazi extermination program and the homicidal gas chambers. Now, like so many of us, we just took it for granted. I was dimly aware, he writes, that there were some authors who questioned even the approximate truth of the official Holocaust version, but I thought they were just a bunch of neo-Nazis eager to whitewash Hitler. So I made no effort to find out what their arguments were. However, I was already quite anti-Zionist at that time because he was disgusted by Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, and he was angry about the way the Jews were exploiting the Holocaust tragedy that he thought had befallen upon the Jews and how they were trying to get huge sums of money out of Germany. And his father was born in Germany and lived there until 1947, and then he moved to Switzerland. So Jürgen says he was a Germanophile from earliest childhood, and he cared about the German people. And then he says that, but he wasn't too interested. He didn't want to learn about the Holocaust because it was just unpleasant. So Jürgen Graf writes, all this changed in April 1991. When I made the acquaintance of an elderly Swiss gentleman, Mr. Arthur Vogt. Vogt, a retired teacher of mathematics and biology, who was born in 1917, has been my close friend and generous sponsor ever since. At our first meeting, he introduced himself as a revisionist and gave me a tape with a revisionist text authored by himself. Even if this text did not convince me entirely, it came as a serious shock to me, and I realized that the revisionists had some valid arguments and could not simply be dismissed as crackpots or charlatans. So I asked Vogt for some more information. He sent me the three revisionist books with which, at that time, were the best existing ones. Serge Tian's title in French, True History or True Politics, something like that. And Arthur Butz's The Host of the 20th Century, and Wilhelm Steglitz's Der Auschwitz Mythos, The Auschwitz Myth. And so you see how good he was. He was using his funds for encouraging people who showed interest and giving them tapes, sending them books even. So Jürgen says, before even studying these books, I read the German translation of an article I also had got from Vogt. It appeared in the Soviet Communist Party's newspaper Pravda on February 2, 1945, 1 week after the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp by the Red Army. The author of that article, Soviet Jewish reporter Boris Polevoy, who had visited Auschwitz immediately after its liberation, wrote about an assembly line killing installation where hundreds of people were killed simultaneously with electrical current. Remember that old story, and people have seen that article too since, so we're familiar with that. And Polevoix, was also mentioned gas chambers in the eastern section of the Auschwitz camp. But nowadays, nobody claims that the Germans made use of electric currents to kill people. And according to the official Holocaust version, the Auschwitz gas chambers were at Birkenau, west of the main camp, and not in the east section. Having read this article, I knew that the revisionists were right. The gas chamber and mass extermination story had been fabricated by propagandists, and the first versions did not tally with the later ones. On that day, April 29, 1991, I decided to dedicate my life to the struggle against the most monstrous fraud ever concocted by human brains. I had long discussions with Arthur Vogt, who appreciated my enthusiasm and often gave me useful advice. Well, that's the end of Jürgen's little piece, and so I'll just say in closing that here we have different revisionists who are useful in different ways, you see. And they're doing different things in different capacities, but they all play their part in increasing the reach, grasp, and power of the revisionist message. What part do you play? What part do I play? Whatever it is, we should try to do it the very best way we can. And tomorrow, as they're having their big event in Poland, we can focus on our revisionists and maybe think about buying and reading or finding it online, reading some of these revisionist texts that are from the past that are as good as anything that's being written today and really show it's kind of like at the very beginning how the light was dawning and how quickly these intelligent men figured it all out and had the courage to stand up against it. So this has been my tribute to revisionists, ladies and gentlemen. And it is January 26, 2015. This is the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I want to say good night and have a good week. See you next week.